Maybe it's the anonymity of social media that has allowed people to publicly expose their most base thoughts and opinions at the drop of a hat, but it's definitely made me recede into the background even more than usual. What little faith I have in people has been lost piecemeal with every ignorant comment lobbed through the internets. The scariest part is day-to-day interaction, whether it be standing in line at the supermarket or eavesdropping in a cafe, hardly ever yields similar comments. Makes me wonder how much of this hate and viciousness brims underneath the surface, and if we're all just one hair trigger away from letting the vitriol spew out like a fire hose of vilification. One needs reassurance. One needs to recharge their batteries every once in a while and not give up hope. For me, it's reconnecting with people who motivate, stimulate, kindle, make me laugh, and are a general all-around great hang. Luckily, I've been fortunate enough to have a few of these types of people in my life. Some where we get together and laugh our asses off over the stupidest shit, and some where all we do is exchange tips on new bands, new movies, new books, and some where you just want to listen to their every word, drinking it up like a tall elixir of inspiration. I met Barrett Martin almost 2 years ago when his band The Walking Papers took part in the Uproar Festival across America with our band, and many more like Alice in Chains, Jane's Addiction, Middle Class Rut, and the Dead Daisies. It was through our previous touring with Duff McKagan, Walking Papers bass player, that allowed our two camps to quickly befriend each other, quicker than usual. And the short time one spends sharing a meal with another eventually became hours. And for someone who doesn't really socialize too much outside of our band's closed circle of band and crew, I was pleasantly surprised to do so with Barrett. Our talks eventually distilled into podcast episodes number 56 and 65. Aside from drumming in the Screaming Trees, Tuatara, Mad Season, and of course, The Walking Papers, Barrett also holds a master's degree in anthropology and linguistics, and teaches at Antioch University, and has taught at New York University, Occidental College, Emory University, the University of Georgia, the University of Alaska, and the University of New Mexico. Most recently, and one of the reasons that prompted this podcast episode, was his recent recording with the great bluesman Cedell Davis on his new album, Last Man Standing. Having put out Cedell's 2002 album When Lightning Struck the Pine, also with his Tuatara bandmate Peter Buck on Barrett's Sunyata record label, now, over 12 years later, Cedell is back, 89 years young, and arguably more popular and virile than ever. The recording is the proof. It's always great to talk to Barrett. Of all the episodes I've done, his two appearances on the podcast yielded the most comments from friends, some who I didn't even know listened to the podcast. It's complimentary, but a testament to Barrett's allure and distinction. There is a quiet club with this podcast, where three appearances automatically enlists you into what is known as the Black Coffee Brigade. Members include Brendan Canning, who was this podcast's first guest on episode number 10, and went on to appear on episodes number 29, number 50, and number 79. Wade McNeil of Alexis on Fire and Gallows is a member, as is JC from our band, as is Ole, our webmaster. Duff McKagan, also from The Walking Papers and Guns N' Roses, is a member, and Damian Abraham, singer of Fucked Up, who has been on this podcast more than any other guest. Now, on the eve of our 100th episode, Barrett Martin slides in to become the newest member of the Black Coffee Brigade. So, congratulations to Barrett. Thank you as well to Blue Mike Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for supporting the podcast. Thanks to Chino Locos for making fish burritos and here in Toronto and stuffing them with chow mein noodles. And thanks to you for listening to the podcast. So, on with the podcast. Here is episode number 99. We've almost made it to 100 with Barrett Martin. And it starts now.
The Take Your Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn and Kidd is taking us going to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes tear me in from fucked up. Stop playing Hang Down, down.
I feel it's absolutely compulsory for you to listen to the Danko Jones podcast. Many times, Liz and I camped out in front of our Fisher 500 hi-fi receiver, hanging on Danko's every word. It's what we used for inspiration when we both starred in Under Milkwood. We even got Peter hooked by the end of the production. Peter O'Toole, that is. I implore you to go now and listen to Danko expound on subject matter most of us don't even think twice about. Listen to him turn anything into podcast gold. It's simply fantastic.
Sometimes Danko goes on and on about Glenn Danzig. The guy just loves Glenn Danzig. And I love that kind of passion, and that's why I love listening to Danko speak. Well, truth be told, I love that Danzig song, Mother. I like that too. Thank God for the Danko Jones podcast.
And I said the Danko Jones podcast makes me feel alright. The Danko Jones podcast makes me feel alright. Number one in the world, one in the world. It makes me feel alright.
Hey, it's Barrett.
Hey, Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's really good to talk with you again because it's been at least over a year and maybe more than that because I can't remember the last time we talked.
Year and a half, closing in on 2 years now.
Man, I cannot believe how fast the time has flown. That's crazy.
Yeah, and, you know, we have this thing on the podcast where if you're on three times.
Yeah.
You are part of this club.
Really?
And this is your third time.
You know, I remember you saying something about that. Cause I think you've had Duff on three times and a couple other people that I respect a lot.
The last person who was inducted into this Black Coffee Brigade, this little club of ours, was Duff.
Wow.
And that was 2 years ago.
Okay. I'm deeply honored.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I have to send you a patch.
Yes.
Everybody gets a patch. Well, you've been very busy.
Yes, I have.
And last time we spoke on the podcast, it was to do with ayahuasca.
That's right. It's interesting you'd bring that one up because I'm literally the last few days I've been rewriting the chapter in my book, which will be my first book, about my experience in the Peruvian Amazon doing ayahuasca ceremonies and learning about the songs of the Shipibo shamans. The Shipibo are the indigenous people that live in the upper Peruvian Amazon, and those are the people that I worked with when I was doing my master's degree research. But I also just have a deep love of those people and the way that they see the world.
Now, this book, this is new. I haven't heard of this.
Well, I haven't been talking about it very much. I guess, really, you'd be the first person that I'm publicly talking about it with. It's a book that I've been working on for a few years. I guess technically you could say that I've been working on it for 20 years because it chronicles my travels around the world, not so much in my rock and roll career, but more when I would travel on my own or when I would take a detour and go study or live with an indigenous group and learn about their culture and their music and their spiritual views of the world. So it starts with, there are a couple chapters about rock and roll. I mean, I talk about the early Seattle music scene because that's where I came from, and it kind of gives people a foundation of understanding who I am and where I come from. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in the Pacific Northwest and being part of that early music movement in the late 80s and early 90s. But then I talk about everything from Aboriginal songlines in Australia to the Maori sea trails and how they navigated the Pacific Ocean and colonizing, you know, most of the Pacific I talk about Native American music and some of the ceremonies and the spiritual meanings behind them that I've participated in. Most of the book is actually about time that I spent in West Africa, in Senegal and Ghana, learning traditional African rhythms from a family of griots, which are the indigenous storytellers of West Africa.
Okay.
A little bit about being in Cuba in 1999 when Bill Clinton was still president and he sent a bunch of musicians to Cuba to work with Cuban musicians.
You mentioned that before.
So I'm just kind of, I'm writing more in depth about those experiences.
Amazing.
And then Central America, Brazil, and then right now I'm working on that that chapter on the Peruvian Amazon and the Shipibo and how they see the world made of song. So I'm not sure when the book is going to come out, but it's getting close to being done, and we'll see if I get a release date for it.
So you've got a publishing company behind you?
Well, not yet. I've got some literary agents and editors that are looking at it, and I also have, you know, my own record label as a viable, you know. I release music and CDs. I suppose I could release a book as well.
Right. Start your own imprint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about the digital age is that we have all of these opportunities. You know, people can write a book and write a manuscript or a screenplay and publish it without having to go through the old traditional channels.
Yeah.
But to have all options. So.
Well, it definitely sounds like an interesting read.
I think so.
Yeah, especially from your perspective and your background. I think a lot of people, it's a nice way to lead people into that world from, you know, your rock and roll start.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think another way to look at it is that music occupies every corner of the earth. You know, I mean, every culture has a way of expressing itself through music. It's kind of the one universal that, you know, there's a saying in ethnomusicology, there's no such thing as a universal in music because every form of music has different, you know, different forms of expression. So the only universal is that everybody has music, you know,
right.
It's just so broad. But I think music needs to be viewed more as a spiritual and cultural expression rather than just a commodity, which is what the Western capitalist world tends to do. You know, I mean, it's fine to sell music and make money. I mean, that's how I earn my living. But I also don't think that you should limit music to just that. It's so much more than that. And we just get conditioned to think of it as a product or a commodity to be bought rather than deep spiritual and cultural expression.
It's a tight rope to walk, especially when you're in it and you're putting out records and you want to keep putting out records.
Yeah.
It's hard to not get caught into the whole numbers and the units and the all the shipments, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, we dealt with that in the late 80s and early 90s. I mean, it's not, that has never gone away. But that was before the internet and the digital age and the ability to dispense music almost instantly around the globe. So that changes the financial parameters of it, but it also makes it more inclusive, you know, so that there's, like, one side of it has kind of fallen away, but another side is emerging, this ability to connect and reach people all over the world, like I said, pretty instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least they have access to it, you know, almost instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, I find, you know, when people ask me, like, oh, how many records did you sell of that album? I've never known. I still don't know how many records we've sold. I don't know anything about who bought what. I just know that we're still able to tour. That's it.
Yeah.
and there's still a deadline to submit a record.
Right, right. Actually, a good friend of mine who works in music law, she told me, now this was about 10 years ago she said this, I'm sure it's different and much higher today, but she said that whatever you've sold or however many CDs you've manufactured and shipped, at least four times that many people have your album. So in other words, for every CD that exists, at least four people have a copy of it, whether they have a CD copy or they burned it onto their computer. And those numbers were from 10 years ago. So it could be much, much more than that at this point. So
yeah, you know, let them have it. Yeah. Just come to the show.
Yeah, exactly. Come to the show and experience the real thing live.
Yeah. And that's one thing we've staked our band name on and our reputation is the live show, so you can't really download it.
That's right.
So we have that going for us.
Well, and, you know, the thing about a live show, like what I've been doing is I've been doing live shows with my instrumental band, Tuatara. We just did a West Coast tour, and, you know, we're kind of like this kind of fusion-y, shamanic dance group. You know, it's kind of jazz, it's kind of electronic, it's got elements of rock, but it grooves really hard and it makes people dance and they just kind of have this great experience. And I think what we have to remember is that a live show with real music, real musicians, real performance, I mean, that is as old as the earliest shamanic ceremonies where the storyteller was leading the listeners on a journey and dancing and, you know, playing a drum, and maybe there were other musicians playing with them. And you're taking the audience, you're captivating the audience and taking them on a journey. So you can do that with a lot of different kinds of music. You can do it with rock and roll. You can do it with electronic music. I mean, really, it's interesting to see the growth in electronic music and, you know, the huge crowds of people that go to see a DJ. And it's, you know, you can get into the debate about whether or not the DJs are even doing anything. I mean, lots of times they're just pushing buttons and just playing stuff that's already recorded. And that might be true, but the point being is that the audience is having this experience with the music. That's really the essential thing that's going on. And so whatever your form is, whether it's rock and roll or electronic or pop or hip hop or jazz or whatever it is, that's an ancient ceremony. It's timeless. It's just that it changes over the centuries and with technology and becomes, you know, it expresses itself differently.
Yeah, I think with a lot of the criticism with, you know, the DJ culture, etc., it comes from musicians and they're looking at it from their perspective, judging everyone else. But everyone is there to experience that communal feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I like a lot of electronic music. I tend to like the more down-tempo stuff. I guess you just call it, you know, kind of chill-out music or ambient music, things like that. I mean, you can create some beautiful textures with electronic sounds.
Right.
But I just think we have to be careful to not replace real musicianship and composition with computers and button pushing. You know, I mean, that's a certain skill set, and it certainly has value, but it shouldn't replace, you know, the other stuff. You know, it's just one other kind of music.
Yeah, I think musicians feel threatened by it.
Sure. Yeah. And I can see why. I do. But I mean, there's also, you have to, once you live long enough, you start to see that there are these trends and these patterns. Right now, electronic music is having a popular trend, but you know, those people will get older, and in 10 years or 20 years, they may not want to be going to gigantic concerts of electronic music. And there could be another form of music that emerges that takes its place. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, in the 1990s, the biggest shows in the world were rock and roll shows. Mm-hmm. And everybody went to see rock and roll because that's where, you know, you, that was your social life, was the people that you met at these rock shows. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, rock is still, I mean, it's still a huge thing in the festival circuit. I mean, the biggest festivals in Europe and the United States are essentially rock festivals. They might have electronic musicians and DJs in the lineup, but they're essentially rock festivals.
Yeah, it's the way I see it is, you know, I like electronic music and hip hop and all that kind of stuff. But when I submerge myself in that world for a long enough period of time, when I finally go back to rock, it's kind of like when you've eaten fast food for a week and then your body just craves like fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, yes.
That's exactly how the feeling I get when I go back to rock.
Yeah, yeah, because it's so organic and natural and visceral and muscular, and it's made by the human mind and body. Like, it's physical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there, you know, you touched on a good metaphor there. You know, we spend a lot of time in front of a computer or looking at our smartphone, basically looking at a square box, usually sitting on our butts, and we can get very cerebral and mental, but not physical.
Oh, yeah.
And there's all kinds of studies now that say that people that sit at their jobs, you know, don't live as long as people that are on their feet or at least moving around, you know, like mm-hmm. being physical, because we are physical beings.
Right.
So I think that there's sort of like a, it's like in our DNA to, we want to move and dance and feel life in our body, and certain kinds of music draw that out of us.
Yeah. I mean, I sit in front of the computer all day long. When I'm not on the road, even when I'm on the road. So I feel like the live show makes up for the whole day, hopefully.
Yeah.
You mentioned Tuatara. And, you know, leading up to this discussion, I went back and I listened to some of the two podcasts we did. And at the time, when we were on tour together on the Uproar Festival, you mentioned that you were in the middle of working on a Tuatara album.
That's right.
So that has since come out.
Yeah, I guess I got to send that to you. I forgot. It actually came out at the end of last summer. So it's already been out for, you know, coming up on a year now. And we didn't really get to tour when it first came out because I was still on the road with Walking Papers and just didn't have time to add another band to the mix. But we ended up making a 20-song double album. It's called Underworld. And it's kind of a shamanic album. It's about, you know, this journey through the underworld. But it's kind of funny and tongue-in-cheek. You know, it doesn't take itself too seriously. The song titles, you know, have kind of funny names like Skeleton Get Down and the Gremlin Chain Gang and, you know, things like that, you know, just sort of like tongue in cheek. But it's a really good groove and record. Like, it makes you want to dance. And so I put this band together of about six other Seattle musicians they range from being, you know, like a virtuosic upright bass player to, and, you know, Skerrick, the famous experimental saxophonist, he's the leader of the horn section. We've got a Senegalese percussionist. I'm playing drums. There's keyboards and guitar and a three-man horn section. And it's really unique and very, very different from anything that I've done before. Because, like I said, it's not rock and roll. It's a mixture of electronics and jazz and just sort of a philosophy that we should groove no matter what. It's got to groove and it's got to make people dance.
So this is your band with Peter Buck, right?
Well, Peter and I started the band almost 20 years ago, but it started as a very different band. It's always been an instrumental band, but when Peter and I were doing it, And Skerrick was also a founding member, and also okay. Justin Harwood, who is the bassist in the band Luna. So the four of us started the band as this instrumental, experimental, like film soundtrack kind of band. And we've made 7 albums now, and it's been, yeah, this is like the 19th year. You know, next year would be our 20 year anniversary. And we've just, the albums have just evolved over time. They just like a human being, you know, they change and evolve. And so a lot of critics said that this new album is probably the best record that we've ever done. And I certainly think it's the most realized. Like, it's a very focused and specific kind of record.
Oh, that's very interesting. I really want to hear it.
Yeah, I'll mail you a copy today for sure. So
yeah, I got to mail you ours as well.
Okay, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, so When we last saw each other, you guys were in the middle of the Walking Papers cycle.
Yeah.
And I think I followed you guys where you were going to Europe. You toured with Alice in Chains there, wasn't it? Or Monster Magnet?
We did. You know, we went to Europe, I think, 6 different times. Some of them were just short little, like we'd just do some shows in the UK, which that's what we did with Alice in Chains. We just did some opening dates in the UK. And then the last tour we did was last summer. We did a bunch of festivals, and we opened some shows for Aerosmith. And then we came back to the United States, and we did some West Coast dates. And we kind of wrapped things up. I think our last show was in L.A. at the Whiskey A Go-Go in November. And so what we did after that is we recorded our new album. It's done. It's mixed and mastered. And we're just trying to find a record label to put it out. And also, you know, we needed to take a break. Everybody was, I mean, that was a lot. That was 2 years on the road, and it was a lot for us. And we all have different things going on right now. You know, Duff has a new book that's just coming out, I think, next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jeff is doing a solo record, and I'm working on this Delta Blues project, which I can tell you about in a little bit. So we just realized that we needed to just pause, and you know, we'll find an appropriate label at some point, and the second Walking Papers record will eventually come out.
Well, it's interesting with Duff. He goes back and forth between Loaded and then Walking Papers, right?
Well, I think, you know, he did a couple Loaded shows. They were doing, like, benefits and fundraisers. I don't think the band is totally active again. I think he's, I mean, maybe he's going to do more shows. But he, yeah, he did have some shows with Loaded. But I think just 2 or 3.
Right. Okay. So when we reconnected to do this podcast, you sent me the new C.D.L. Davis album that you're on, Last Man Standing.
That's right, yeah.
I read the HuffPost article that you wrote, giving me the complete background history of the project.
Yeah.
I heard the album. It's an amazing record.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
You recorded it in a church or a cathedral?
Okay, yeah, the story, we recorded this last summer. It was right after I got back from the last Walking Papers tour, and we recorded it in Water Valley, Mississippi at the Fat Possum Recording Studio, which is actually in a house, but the house used to be the parsonage of a Methodist church, which the church is still there, and it still has a congregation. It's a tiny place. I mean, I don't think there's more than, you know, a couple thousand people in Water Valley, Mississippi, but it's just a beautiful, enchanting place. I mean, the Delta is I've driven through there so many times, but every time, you know, it's a different experience. And it really, really affected me as a musician and as a drummer to work with somebody who's 89, well, he's about to turn 89 in June. He and B.B. King are the same age and grew up within 100 miles of each other. And the story of C. Del Davis's life, you know, everything that he went through from polio and, you know, yellow fever and being trampled and having his legs broken and being in a wheelchair for most of his life and still, still being able to sing the greatest blues. It just kind of changed how I thought about what it is to be a musician and, you know, what it really means to do this work, you know, when you're alive on Earth. You know, and especially when you're somebody like C. Del, who dedicated his entire life to it. So the album came out. It's still getting rave reviews. It's kind of building as we go. And now we're doing a documentary film. We filmed a bunch of footage in Mississippi, you know, in the studio and playing, you know, some live shows. And then now what we're doing is... on June 14th, we're doing a show here in Seattle at the Crocodile, which is, of course, the famous rock club of Seattle. And yes. I'm the musical director, and I've put together a show that includes myself on drums, Peter Buck of REM on guitar, Mike McCready of Pearl Jam on guitar, and then Van Conner from Screaming Trees, my old bandmate. He's going to play bass on some songs.
Oh, nice.
So we'll have the old Screaming Trees rhythm section on some songs. This amazing upright bass player from Tuatara, his name is Evan Flory Barnes. He's gonna do some songs because we're gonna do some acoustic blues. And basically, I've got a revolving cast of, you know, very well-known musicians and sort of unknown but up-and-coming musicians. So it's kind of a passing of the torch sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we're basically showing the roots of the blues in rock and roll. And we're just doing it in Seattle because that's, you know, that's where I'm from. But also, you know, Peter Buck and I played on C. Del's previous album, which is called When Lightning Struck the Pine.
Right.
We recorded back in 2002. So Peter and I have a long connection with C. Del. And I think we're doing something good with this because we're really showing the importance of the men and women that, you know, created the blues, because it is the foundational music for everything, for jazz, rock and roll, R&B, you know, country blues, and even hip hop. You know, it all goes back to the blues, and it all goes back to the Mississippi Delta.
Well, you doing it at Fat Possum HQ, I mean, that's a label that's really,
oh yeah,
yeah, kept the blues alive with all their releases, whether it's R.L. Burnside, Junior Kimbrough.
Yeah, I love all that stuff. I mean, they put out some of the early C. Del Davis records. I mean, they kind of brought C. Del back out of obscurity, and I'm friends with Bruce Watson, the president of the label, and so he's actually been very helpful in you know, kind of helping promote this. So, but sometimes, you know, you just sort of feel like you have an obligation to shine a spotlight on somebody that maybe didn't get it when they. You know, when they deserved it. And so now we have a chance to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting because that album you mentioned, When the Lightning Struck the Pine, that was in 02, right?
Yeah, that was done in 2002. And it was produced by Joe Cripps, who is a percussionist down in Texas. And so he asked me to put a band together, and I basically just got Tuatara. You know, I got myself, Peter Buck, mm-hmm. Scott McCoy, Alex Veeley, who was our keyboard player, and we were essentially the backup band for C. Del. We basically made the record in just a few days, two or three days, I think, of, you know, principal recording in Denton, Texas, in a bar. And we rented out the bar so that we could record during the day when nobody was there, but then we would also, you know, bring in the audience at night and record in front of an audience. I think we did that two nights in a row. It was like a Friday and a Saturday night, or maybe a Saturday and a Sunday night, something like that. So the album has both, you know, both this, you know, studio quality and a live quality. It's pretty neat.
Now in 02, he was 78, late 70s.
I think he would have been, you know, in his mid 70s, 75, 76, I think.
Now, from, you know, between the age of 26 and 36, there's not much of a physical change, really. But from 78 to late 80s, was there a huge difference that you noticed with Seidel, like, in terms of making this record with him?
Well, yeah, he's a bit more... Well, for one thing, you know, he can't play slide guitar anymore. He had a mild stroke in 2005, and it just impaired his ability to play slide guitar. So now he just sings. But in some ways, you know, he's got such a rich voice. I mean, the way I wrote it in those liner notes, it's as rich as the soil of the Mississippi Delta. I mean, it's just got so much life and history in his voice that he just focuses on singing now. And of course, he's still in a wheelchair, but it's pretty extraordinary. Because I did, you know, a handful of shows with him down in the Delta where I played drums, and you know, he's got kind of a new band that takes care of him and tours with him.
Father's son.
Greg and Zach Binns, and then the harmonica player is a registered nurse who, you know, looks after Seidel when they're on the road. Oh, and they've already done two tours of Europe like this. I mean, Seidel's actually having more success now than he's ever had at any point in his life. So it's pretty amazing, you know, to sit behind him on the drum set and just lay down these beats, and then he just sings.
Yes. That's the one thing about that marks the record is the timbre of his voice is so, you know, he's lived a life.
Yeah.
That cuts through anything. That cuts through all the lyrics, the songs, the music. It just cuts through everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
You can't put that on, you, no matter how great of an impressionist you are.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that, I mean, we were just talking about electronic music and how, you know, how perfect and clean and digital it is. And this is like the exact opposite of it. It's totally... human and organic, and it's full of mistakes and flaws and imperfections, but that's the way life is. Life is full of, I mean, this music represents what life actually is. Life is full of mistakes and regrets and missteps, and you learn and you deepen yourself as you go. And I really don't know anybody other than Seidel, you know, of that age who has that kind of wisdom and experience.
You make a mention in the article, the introductions to the songs, and you compare it to kind of the Chicago 12-bar blues, very strict, standard, confined way of blues, where this just starts when it does.
Yeah, I think, you know, when the blues moved upriver initially to St. Louis and then on to Chicago, you know, it started to get real codified, and, you know, we got this, you know, 12-bar, 1-4-5 chord progression, but that's not really how it is in the Delta, and I think it started very differently. You know, there are these, sometimes, you know, you never leave the one, you know, you just stay on the one and you don't go to any other chord changes. A lot of Junior Kimbrough stuff is like that, mm-hmm. which is what, it, but he's such a melodic singer that you don't realize that the chord progression never changed. It's just his voice and his emotion that changed. And so when you play this old Delta music, you know, it kind of stops and twists and turns, and it kind of reminds me of a boxer. You know, it turns on a dime and it snaps around, and, you know, you have to, like, be real intuitive and fast and be able to switch like that. And so It's definitely music that keeps you on your toes. You'd think that it'd be really simple, and in some ways it is, but on the other side of it, you have to be very intuitive and awake to play it.
Another comparison that you made with the record is how you guys were making this kind of secular-type music within this church.
Yeah.
And how the two are necessary to be together, the spiritual with, I don't know, the earth or the I don't know how to describe it, but
well, it's like the classic dichotomy of the sacred and the profane. You know, you have the sacred liturgical music of the church, and then you have the quote profane music of the blues. You know, which started out as music of the brothels, and it was party music. You know, and you know, it still is party music in the sense that it makes people feel good. And so in some ways, the two musics are very similar. You know, religious music makes people feel spiritual and whole and connected to God. And the blues, the reason why it's so influential in all forms of music is that when you have a song that's about pain and suffering, people actually like it because it reminds them that they're not alone in their pain and suffering. They're connected to other people that are going through the same thing. Now, and the lyrics can still have humor and lightheartedness, but maybe, you know, maybe there's still an underlying, you know, a general theme of pain and suffering that people connect to. So that is also healing. You know, it's all healing.
I like how you did compare it with the spiritual and yes, the profane. To me, that is the essence of rock and roll. Where, kind of to paraphrase, where the gutter mixes with the stars. Yeah. That's the essence of rock and roll, to me.
Yeah, in Buddhism, they call that the mud and the sky.
Yeah.
Both things are real in the sense that, you know, we experience both mud and we can see the sky. It's also an illusion, you know. It's not. It's just, you know, a molecular construct that we're existing in. But it represents, you know, the polarities of life. You know, the bottom and the top. You know, heaven and hell. But out of mud comes life. You know, and so, you know, you go far enough on to each end of the continuum, and you kind of come back to the same place. I think rock and roll is very much like that because it can be very cathartic and healing to express, you know, that kind of power through amplified music. I mean, that's what I loved about rock and roll when I was a kid. And that was the music that was popular in the 70s and 80s. It was rock and roll. And I mean, it can take a whole lot of different forms, but I'm in agreement with you, man. It's healing.
Now, are you going to tour this album? How much can he tour?
Well, you know, we're going to play some select shows. I mean, right now the only show we have is this June 14th show at the Crocodile with this kind of, you know, all-star backup band. And, mm-hmm. I think there's talk of him going back to Europe. I don't know if I can do the European tour because of my schedule, but maybe I will be able to. It remains to be seen, but right now we're kind of focusing on documenting this concert and this film. That's kind of our main focus.
Right.
I mean, when do you see him? Tour that much. I mean, he can play a handful of shows and go to Europe for 2 weeks, but you know, he is 89 years old and in a wheelchair, yeah. So there's a limit to what he can do.
Yeah. And when do you see this documentary being released?
I don't know when it'll be released, but I know that they're already editing the footage we have, and then they'll add in this, you know, this live performance footage. So I would think, you know, by the end of the year they'll probably have something to present. But when it's released, I don't know yet.
Right. Wow, that's really exciting. And now that you have the Walking Papers with a new album in the can, you're pretty much sitting on the cusp of a hell of a lot of work
ahead of you. It could be, the funny thing is I've been in this business for a long time and I've seen things, you know, you just never know. You never know what album is going to take off and when you'll be asked to tour or who's available to tour, you know?
Yeah.
Right now, I'm just kind of enjoying, like, I'm just in Seattle and I literally don't have a show on the calendar except for June 14th. I have nothing booked for the rest of the year, nothing. And it's interesting to go from being on the road with your life planned 6 months ahead And then suddenly you're at home and you don't have anything really planned. And it's kind of nice to just rest in that and just be able to kind of survey the survey your life and figure out, you know, what you're going to do next. So I'm spending a lot of time writing. You know, I'm working on some new essays for Huffington Post, and I'm working on my book.
Well, you know, we have talked in the past about doing that band, remember?
I do remember. So I'm wondering when you might want to do that.
I know. I am in the middle of where you were about last year.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure when we can do it, but I would, you know, I'm down. I love doing stuff like that.
Let's do it, man. I mean, I'll either come out to Toronto or you come out to Seattle and, you know, well, yeah, because, you know, we got to get Jack involved. So, yeah.
Jack and Dino.
Yeah. Actually,
does Jack know?
You know, I did mention this to him, but, you know, I'm working with Jack on this Seidel thing because not only do we have the show on June 14th, but the 3 or 4 days before that, we're in the studio recording all these old Delta songs with this kind of all-star backup band. So I got Jack to be the engineer on that. So, I mean, you can't do a project like this without Jack and Dino being involved.
I think, I cannot remember why, but the three of us were all CC'd on a email thread 2 years ago.
That's right.
I can't remember why.
I think we just probably, you know, jump-started that idea of doing the power trio or something like that.
Right.
So, but yeah, we got to do that at some point. We just have to.
Yeah, some point this something's got to be done.
Yeah.
Well, meeting him 2 years ago in Seattle at the show was pretty cool and heavy for myself.
Oh yeah, that's just right. Knowing. That was when we were out at the Columbia River Gorge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A big day for me. I had a blast. And I love Seattle. You know, I love all the Seattleites that I've met. It's kind of like batting 1,000 with Seattleites.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, Barrett, this has been great, man.
Likewise.
Great way to catch up.
Thank you, Danko. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
And I know when the Walking Papers album comes out, our paths will cross.
I'm sure they will.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, sir.